define everything.
I would say that you are somebody that has and is disrupting the sales industry.
And this is where I have a dark side. This is probably going to ruin my career.
Hey, people, what's going on? This is Keenan. Listen, I want to break down something that few people are talking about when it comes to sales.
Guys, I love you salespeople. I do. I love you.
Most people wouldn't take that job. They won't bet on themselves.
Man, I've read your pathetic emails. I see your pathetic cold call campaign, and it makes me want to throw up in my mouth.
Jill likes to say suck offline, suck online. I say suck at sales, suck at sales.
Get to the measurables.
No, you can't have 15 minutes of my time.
Get to the facts.
To hear about the cool features of your little product. No, you cannot.
And that's something sales is missing. When people bet on themselves, they work harder.
You got to stop.
There's no safety net.
This shit is bullshit. No one wants it.
Why should I bet on you if you won't bet on you?
Put yourself in the shoes of your buyer.
Bet on yourself. It's the only way to win. Cut.
Take two.
Take two. Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the We Have a Meeting podcast. And boy, am I excited for today's episode. We have a returning guest, and not just any returning guest. They were one of the most streamed episodes last year. This could be down to their passionate nature, the way they disrupt the industry, or purely just because they're so lovely. Our guest today is author of the best-selling sales book, Gap Selling, CEO of a sales growth company. Our guest today is none other than Keenan. Keenan, how are you?
What up, baby? I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's always great to have you. You always bring the energy. Whenever it's the start of a new quarter, I like to listen to a podcast or your audio book because it gives me a kick up the arse. You're one of those people that your voice gives me a Wellington right in the backside. So we asked you this last time.
I like getting asked.
And I'm going to ask you again. Who are you and what problem do you solve?
Oh, my God. Who am I? I'm just a guy making his way, man. Just like every other person trying to do good by his family, by his kids, for himself, and make the world a better place. I mean, that's just that. I think at the end of the day, that's what I really want to do, just make the world a better place where I'm best equipped to do that. And then what problems do I solve? Well, as it relates to my business, the problems I solve are organizations who are struggling with making quota, people with long sales cycles, organizations that have low ASP, and or they have low win rates. So from a business perspective, those are the types of problems we solve. From a life perspective, I'm a guy who gets people to think about where they are and what they're trying to accomplish, and gets people who are struggling or aren't even aware. I bet probably people aren't even aware they're not where they want to be. I'm the guy that makes you look yourself in the mirror.
It's a very modest answer. I would argue that you're not just a guy. I would say that you are somebody, I know that you have many accolades, but I would say that you are somebody that has and is disrupting the sales industry. Why so passionate? Why do you want to get people better?
Isn't that why we're here? Like literally, isn't that why we're here? I'm not a religious man, so I need no disrespect to anybody. So whatever why you believe here or what brought you here, okay, is great. But I believe that once you're here, everything should be about improvement because humans are fallible, right? Like because we can think and because we've set up paradigms and rules and societies and structures and expectations, because we do that, because the animal kingdom can't do that, which I think they're lucky because they can't. But because we've done that, then everything we should do should be improving, right? We should always be trying to improve. And so if you're always trying to improve, then you should be trying to help people improve. You should be advancing, always advancing. Now, always advancing doesn't mean technology. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that we should be looking at a problem and ask ourselves, is this as good as we can get? And if it's not, how do we make it better? So that's just how I operate. It's how I think. It's how I process. It's everything I do. So when it came to selling, I started to see a lot of issues, particularly from the buyer side. Buyers don't like salespeople, buyers are frustrated with salespeople, buyers can't, don't feel they're getting anywhere from salespeople, which then translated into poor win rates, that translated into organization not making quota, which translated into sales team performing poorly. So because of this tension or this situation, I was like, well, this isn't helping anybody. Buyers aren't happy, sellers aren't happy, so let's fucking fix it. And so that's just how I got there. I mean, I appreciate you calling me modest, and it's usually not something that's attached to me, but I don't set out to disrupt for the sake of disruption. I just, if I see something that can be better and I don't, okay, this is what I do. I don't believe in fences or barriers. I don't subscribe to that. Well, this is how it's done, so fix it in this little corral. No, fuck you. Like, if fixing in this corral doesn't fix it, I'm going out. Like, I'm going off the plantation. I'm going somewhere else, and I'm going to figure it out. So that can be disruptive because you don't play by people's rules, maybe, or don't meet their expectations. But outside of that, I don't really think of myself as a quote-unquote disruptor or anything like that. I just want to make things better.
I love that. It's like, if you're not learning, you're not living, right? And beautifully put.
It's in everything. Like, it blows my mind and it almost makes me sad how little thought most people put into most things. They think surface level. One of the ones that really jumps out, there's two things that really jump out at me when it comes to people that put so little effort into it, or thought, not effort, thought. One is parenting and the other one is their basically their life or their career. Right? They, or in their relationships, marriage, they put so little thought into them. So because they put so little thought into it, they play at surface level emotional reaction situations, and therefore they can't be proactive. They can't be responsive. They can't be constructive because everything eventually turns into a reactive shit show. Right? Like, and you just watch how kids are being raised today. All parents jumped into parenting with is, I love my child. I want to protect my child. That's about as far as they go in their head. They never stop and think, well, what does protecting mean? What does it mean to love my child? What values am I trying to instill? How am I instilling those values? How am I going to respond to their behavior? What am I going to let them get away with? How am I triggered by their behaviors? What am I doing to make this happen? They never ask any of those fucking questions. And then they got a kid who's sitting in a fucking restaurant on their goddamn iPhone that never looks up, doesn't talk to other adults, screams and cries and don't get their way. And then they're shocked when that little shitbag doesn't do anything in their life. I just, the whole thing blows my mind. We just, same thing with the marriage, same thing with their career. They get shocked that they're unhappy in their job. They get shocked that they can't go anywhere else because why? They spent all this money buying all this stuff, so now they can't leave. They get shocked that they're not connecting with their wife because people don't think and don't build a foundation. And then from that foundation, they don't know how to process to get where they want to go. They just react. Blows my mind.
Jack's weeks away from welcoming his first child into the world, so it might have been a timely thing to
put the iPad down.
Yeah, put the iPad down, Jack. Keep that in mind. So, am I right in thinking Gaps Allen's just turned 5? Have I got my maths right?
Yeah, your math is right.
So, if you were looking back now when you could write the book again, is there any chapters that you'd add based on the 5 years' knowledge? With it being out, anything you'd add and why would you add that?
I think there's two things I would do. One is kind of small, but powerful. And I keep saying I'm going to write a revision. I'm sure I will one of these days. I just don't hate doing things over. I'd rather just redo them rather than do them, you know, than to change them. And that is risk-based selling. So you guys understand the concept of gap selling. You have to find a problem, right? A problem that exists. And then how that problem impacts the organization, the whole current state piece, right? Well, after I wrote the book, we started training. We found out there's a small handful of industries that problems don't exist. Their whole existence is about either minimizing the impact of the problem or preventing the problem, right? So actually no problem exists. So cybersecurity is an example of that. Insurance is an example of that. So you can't go, if you sell cybersecurity, you can't go into most of your customers and say, oh, are you currently having a cyber attack, right? Or did you just have a cyber attack? Those are so few and far between. Then 80%, 95% of your customer base hasn't had one. And you're trying to convince them that they're at risk of having one and need to buy your service. You see what I'm saying? To prevent that from happening. So we created what we call a risk-based selling matrix, which helps organizations like that assess or measure the risk and find out where the buyer is. And I won't bore you with it too much, but it's a four quadrant matrix that probabilities on one side, impact should the thing happen. And the idea is if the impact isn't super high and the probability of it happening isn't super high, you'll never sell them. And so as a salesperson, you need to understand where is their perception on that matrix so that you can influence either, oh, they don't think it's that probable. Let me get them, see how probable it is. Or they think it's going to happen, but they don't think the impact's going to be that high. So let me show them that the impact of this, if it happens, is massive and they can't afford it to happen. So I'd add that. And the other thing I would do is I would completely redo the prospecting piece. Completely redo the prospecting piece because outbound is so fucked up right now. And the way I go back and read it now, I'm like, it's so outdated. It's just, prospecting is a shit show. So I'd redo that.
I mean, there's some obvious follow-up questions there, right? You've set me up. If I'm, let's start with the risk-based selling. So if I am risk-based selling, how hard is it to get someone emotional about a problem that doesn't exist when I'm having a discovery call?
It's very difficult because what you're trying to do is you're trying to address their perception. Now, I always do this and it always pisses people off, but that's why I have fun. That's probably why I'm considered disruptive. I just go to places that people won't go. The greatest example I can use, not even a metaphor, but example of this concept of risk-based selling was COVID, right? And if you looked and you had did a survey of all the people who avoided or did not take the shot, right? I could plot them on that four quadrant matrix. And I would say a decent percentage of them were in the bottom left. They didn't believe they were going to get it, period. So that's the low probability, right? And then if they even did believe they were going to get it, they didn't think they were going to die. That there was nothing. It's like just like a cold. Do you see what I'm saying? So I could have plotted most of your anti-vaxxers in that bottom left. Okay. You probably could have plotted a handful of them in the top left. It's like, yeah, I'm going to get it, but it's not going to hurt me at all. Do you see what I'm saying? So that's high probability, but low impact. It's not going to hurt me. So the majority of them, you could have plotted in those two left. You probably could have plotted a handful in the bottom right where they, I'm sorry. Just the bottom left. Because there was nobody on the right. They didn't think it would hurt them or they didn't believe it was real. So there's going to be no impact, right? So they would have been plotted on the bottom left or the top left. Now, those who did get the vaccination, the majority of them I could have plotted in the top right, right? That is, I'm going to get this sucker, and if I get it, it could really, really hurt me. Those are the people who went and got the jab, right? So to your question, if you had to get more and more people in that top right, you had to understand where they were. Now, if they didn't believe it was real, you're probably fucked from there because there's no information you're going to give them to show that it's real. But that is one of your objectives. You would have had to show them or teach them or get them to believe that it's real and that the impact is real. So move them on the impact axis, or you had to move them on the probability axis. Like, let me show you how probable you are to get this or the chance of you getting this. So that's what you had to do, is understand where they were in the plot and then influence either one of those axes, right? Now, what I joke about, and this really upsets people, is I promise you, and this is where I have a dark side. This is probably going to ruin my career, but this is where I have a dark side. Part of me wants this to happen. Not really inside, just because I hate conflict based on ignorance. Every one of these people who's anti-vaxxer, right? If a strain of COVID comes out tomorrow with a 98% transmission rate and a 95% mortality rate within 4 days, but the fucking vaccine keeps you from dying. I mean, not keep you from getting sick, but you do not die. I promise you that every one of these motherfucking vaxxers will last about a week and a half before they are running to their local hospital begging for the shot. It's only going to take about 2, 3, or 4 of their closest anti-vaxxer friends to die right in front of their face. Now the impact has moved to the far right. And oh, by the way, every single person they've talked to who's been around someone got it. Now it's moved up on the probability. Every one of these fuck the government, blah, 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 anti-vaxxers is running and begging and pleading to get it. Pleading, desperate to get it. The only reason we have a controversy now is because the perception is too vague and there's not enough, it's not as devastating to everybody, so it allows people to move in and out of any one of those quadrants at any given time.
This is what I need at the start of the year. I feel like I want to have a fucking fight with someone or something, though. Beautiful.
Right.
But you and see then, 100%. And then the other thing that I wanted to ask you about, because why would I not want to ask you this now you've said it? If you were to redo the prospecting part, what's one thing that you would, if you could only focus on one thing that you want to add or give your perspective on, what would that one thing be?
I don't know if there's one thing, because I'm still trying to sift through what is going on in outbound right now. I don't feel like an expert in the outbound anymore because it's changed so much and there isn't really a consistent plan that is working for everybody. I mean, one of my Beth Collin, I love her. She's still a fan and she's still supportive, but, and she says it works, but I still think she's only found a way to work in a few places anymore. And she'll probably get mad at me for saying that, but so I don't know if it's one thing. I think the market's still settling or the space is still settling. I would say this, and people aren't going to like it. The one thing that I see that is working, it just takes too long for most organizations, is content creation at the rep level. So getting the rep in the organization, getting salespeople to create content, share content, talk about content, teach, educate as much as they can every single day across as many platforms as possible is still working. Where our business is 95% inbound.
So you said, obviously outbound is fucked. We were talking about that. What are, because people will be listening to this thinking like, we know what it's like, Keenan, and people thinking, I don't have a problem. I'm okay. So what are, if outbound is fucked, what does that look like? What are the symptoms of that? If I'm going to listen to this on my walk to work, what are you going to say right now that's going to make me sit up and listen and go, fuck, yeah, maybe we do have a problem?
That's a fantastic question. Fantastic question. Look, the symptoms are this, that you're making 1-200 calls and you're getting one or two connections. So the first part about, from my perspective, the reason that outbound is so fucked is because connection rates. I can't influence those. And everybody's like, oh, well, yes, you can call at different times. Like, okay, you maybe move the needle this much. Just please stop. There's not a repeatable, effective way to get people to pick up the phone. Okay. You can't. Okay. Same thing with emails. Emails are getting filtered faster. They're not reading them, et cetera. So the first thing is if you're making calls and you're making hundreds of calls before you get a pickup or even one connection for 50 to 75 calls or more, you're in trouble. You're not in trouble if you're getting connection rates for every, I would say 20 or less calls. I think you're not in trouble. So that means if you make 80 calls, you can get 4 setups. It's not ideal. That's a lot of calls just for 4 pickups, but I mean, that's executable. You can do that, right? Another one is when they do connect, you're not getting them to set meetings. So you're not able to set meetings or your meeting set rate is really low. So if you are getting connections at all and every 4 people, you know, you're only getting one meeting for every 8, 9, 10 connections. Okay. Again, do the math, right? So if it takes 10 connections to get one meeting, right? That, and it takes 50 calls or 100 calls to get 10, that's 1,000 calls, right? To get 10 meetings, to get one, I mean, to get, I can't talk, 10 connections to get one meeting, 1,000 calls for one meeting. That's not sustainable, right? So you just ask, just the way to do it is take a look at your entire process. Go from connections to meetings, scheduled, people showing up, opportunities created, opportunities closed, and ask yourself, how many calls and emails does it take to get from there to even an opportunity, even forget the closing, opportunity and then close. And if you're starting to talk about thousands of emails and thousands of calls, it's not sustainable. It's too much work.
Is there
another way of doing it too? How much does that SDR create and close business, right? From their outbound efforts? How much is that SDR against what you're paying them and against all the tools you're paying them?
Is there an argument to be made though, if I'm a business owner, and obviously that's something that you can do, and you can go out and you're actually, you might not be in control of the people that, obviously we know that with outbound cold and cold calling, there's not much that you're in control of. But if you're sat there and you're creating content, yeah, you can create great content, but you're still at the same, you're at the mercy of people that see it. There's not much that you can control. Are you saying content marketing over outbound completely, or it's just everybody needs to wake up and switch on to that?
Well, see, that's where I put the asterisk. I don't know what to say yet. That more than anything, what I can tell you is here at ASG, we're leaning on the content marketing. Because here's why. I believe you can control content marketing. Why? When I sit down, and let's just kind of simplify this. If I sit down and I'm going to spend 2 hours making calls, right? Whether I use a dialer or emails and outreach, whatever, right? I can control that message, and I hopefully they pick up, okay? But that message is an email trying to get someone to take action immediately, okay? Where if I spend that 2 hours researching and creating content that educates people and gets people interested and provides value to them, not in a selling environment, but a learning environment. And then I drop that shit on LinkedIn, or I drop that shit on TikTok, wherever I do it. That is going to, without a doubt, get more eyeballs every single time. Every single time, it's going to get more eyeballs. If I get really, really good at that, it's going to get more eyeballs every time. More people are going to read it. More people are going to reach out to me. It's going to make more of a connection. And then when they're ready to buy, or they're thinking about buying, they're going to call me, or they're going to connect with me. So without a doubt, that I have more control over, because when you take salesperson A and salesperson B, or marketing company A and marketing company B, they will create different content, right? And sometimes that content is good for some people and it's not good for other people. So I can be a better content creator than everybody else, right? And I'm going one to many. If I can be a better email writer, yes, I may have more luck, but I'm still going one to one.
I get it. And I think the best salespeople, especially in outbound in 2024, I think the best salespeople are going to be the people that can do it all. I can write a great email. I can create great content, yes, and I can be 100%. A killer on the phone and host a fucking good discovery.
Yeah.
I'm going to say something here. And I'm guessing if it was a LinkedIn status, you would have people in your comments arguing with you till they're blue in the face. Selling to a customer's need is wrong.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
So if people are arguing with you, why are they wrong?
Look, there's some subtleties and nuances to this, but the concept is you find customer says, oh, I need a new t-shirt. I need a new car. I need, and so you start selling to that. The assumption of selling to need is that that they understand what their needs are, that they've properly assessed their environment, that they understand the environment they're playing in, they understand what's going on. Well, in most cases, particularly in B2B, they haven't, and they don't. And so if you start trying to react to that need-based selling, you could miss the mark or sell them the wrong thing, right? And even worse, and this happens all the time, as the sales process proceeds and they start looking at other people and other things and they start learning more and they start moving away from you, you can't pull them back because you don't understand why they're making the decision they're making. You don't understand the root causes to the problem. You don't understand the problems they're trying to solve. You don't understand the impact of the problems that exist. You don't understand the desired outcomes. So you can't pull them back. And they say things, well, you know, I'm not sure you don't have this feature. So, you know, maybe we're not going to go this direction, or we're concerned about how you do this. And you have no idea why that feature matters. And you have no idea why that we can't do A, B, and C is an issue, because you don't understand what they're trying to solve. So you put yourself in a serious disadvantage when you try to sell to someone's need. Need is what the customer thinks they want. Sell to solving the problem, and you're actually giving them what they actually need.
Beautifully put. I think sometimes I like to give people these like real world examples. I'm sure gap selling, like the stuff that we do, takes from therapy and Alcoholics Anonymous and yep. all sorts of stuff. But if someone needs to stop drinking and being an alcoholic, they just know, I need to stop drinking. They don't know why they drink. That's why they go to Alcoholics Anonymous, so they can find out the root cause of that problem and solve yep. it. So yep. sometimes you have to put these selling scenarios in the real world, and people go, oh yeah, actually that makes perfect sense. Now I've realized I'm a human being dealing with other human beings. So yeah, beautifully put. Another maybe misnomer in sales is this thing around relationship building. Mm-hmm. We're business owners. I find it creepy when people try and build relationships with me and they've stalked my LinkedIn profile. They know things about the high school I went to. So for you, is rapport building about how much research I've done on Keenan? Is it about the questions I ask or the answers I give? Which one is it for you where you think, right, I'm gelling with this person though?
For me, rapport building is the questions primarily. It's all three, but it's questions I ask. In other words, am I asking questions that make this person believe that I understand their world? The best way to describe it is go to a doctor. And the doctor who asks you the best questions to understand where you are is the one that makes you feel most comfortable, right? And the doctor who doesn't ask you the best questions or doesn't ask you many questions is the one who makes you feel the least comfortable. So it, to me, it starts with asking questions that suggest I know what I'm talking about. And they appreciate the questions because it's getting them to think about their environment and that, ooh, that's a good question. Like, I didn't think about that, or that's something I need to consider, or that wasn't on my radar. I appreciate you bringing me there because that's going to help me make a better decision.
Based on that, if I've got to show someone quickly that I'm an expert in their space, that I know what I'm talking about, but they're maybe going to judge me on that first one or two questions, typically, what are your go-to opening maybe one or two questions that get someone to think, okay, this guy's asking me the right kind of things. He knows what he's talking about. If I'm an organization with a sales team who might have problems that you solve.
So I think my first question is, what environment are you in where you have to, how did you say that? Have to tell them something at first? Or get, like, why are you even in that environment?
As in, maybe it's a inbound inquiry. They've seen the content that you've been putting out there and they're like, you know what, you might be able to help me with something. Can we set up a discovery call?
Yeah. So the very first question I ask is, hey, thanks for calling in, Zach. Now, let's just say you did a lead form, right? You might have said something like, you know, you're interested in talking to somebody about sales training. Could you take a second to talk me or walk me through what's going on? That's my very first question. Right. Very first question. Now, I want you to process through this from a human lens. What type of person is going to say, no, just tell me what you offer? And if that's their tact, I try to break it. But after two or three, I'm like, fuck it. Go somewhere else. Like clearly you thought that there was enough value in my content, our website, an ad that you thought we could help. So I'm asking you to tell me the fuck is going on so I can see if I can help you. If you aren't in that position, I don't want to do business with you because you're probably a numbskull and you're going to make bad decisions and you're not going to listen to me. So I don't want to work with you in the first place. Like, I didn't say, tell me what your daughter's name is. I didn't say, tell me what's in your bank account. I simply said, fantastic. Tell me what's going on. Can you give me a little bit of information on what's going on with your sales team? And then shut the fuck up and listen. And then you should very easily from there be able to ask follow-on question after follow-on question. I have not and cannot think of a time or a situation. No, that's not true. that I had to start talking about this, but I made this mistake once about, it cost me a deal, about $150,000 deal. I had a past client who was a CRO. He called me up. We wanted to do some work. I asked, got all these questions answered. He told me what the problem was because he knew gap selling, but then his CEO wanted to meet me I made a horrible assumption. The assumption was that the CEO understood the problems is the same as the CRO and they had talked. And so he asked me about gap selling. And I took the bait. Biggest mistake I made. I took the bait and started talking about gap selling. And it turns out he hadn't talked to the CRO that much, number one. Number two, it turned out that he fancied himself, that's English, he fancied himself expert in sales. And so started arguing with me over some of the concepts. And then, well, I used to train this and train that and da-da-da. And I was like, ah, fuck, I just stepped in it. So generally speaking, though, you're not going to find yourself in those situations.
I find it baffling that, especially when you're training people, that people are so unprepared that they think, okay, if they say this, it's like it's got to be a flow chart in so many salespeople's head of if they say this, I ask this. Where it's like, if you just step back and listen and ask genuine questions and mirror and label, and you just dig deeper, like. Obviously we know because we've read the book, but when you're on a call, what what does it take for you to be happy with an answer? Like what are you genuinely looking for you to say, yeah, that's deep enough. You've actually given me the truth there. How many times do you have to keep digging until you get there?
The primary thing I'm looking to is understand. So at this, at a macro level, I'm trying to understand why you would want to spend the money, why you would want to go through the change. Like that's, for me, that's my motivation, is I'm almost trying to almost looking to disqualify by qualify. Like I need to understand why. Mm. Why do you want sales training? Like that costs money. That takes time. In my head, and I'm not saying this, in my head, I'm like, that costs money. That takes time. That's a lot of work. Why just not keep doing what you're doing? Why would you invest $50,000, $150,000, $200,000, $300,000, $400,000? What's going on that would make you feel you need to make that kind of investment? And if I can't understand after asking a lot of questions why they would, then I know that sale's not going to happen.
Mm.
Right. So that's my main driver, is not to sell anything. It's to get to a place where you've given me enough information where I'm like, oh shit, okay, I get it. I see why you guys need to make this investment. Then I can shift to the future state and say, so what are we trying to accomplish now? If this is going on and that's going on and this is happening, where do we want to be? Like, what's going on? And what happens if we don't get there? Right. So that's really what the gap is all about. It's understanding the current state and why staying where you are is not okay. Right. Whether the current state is untenable and intolerable. And then from there, okay, so then what is it you're trying to achieve and why is that so important? What happens if you don't achieve it? So that's really what I do in my discoveries. It's simply so I can understand. And if I can't understand, I'm never comfortable.
And I'm sure that you have been in situations where you've not felt comfortable. You've told them that you don't feel comfortable and they've probably said, brilliant, Keenan, we want to do business with you. Have you got anything anecdotally like that?
Yeah, I mean, we're working on a massive deal right now. And I think we're driving them crazy. We may lose it because of it. And, you know, I have to learn how to pivot because I can't lose this kind of business. It's a multi seven figure deal. And massive company. And they just haven't done the work yet. Like, they think they have. They keep saying what they need. We need this. We need this. And the team's not doing, I'll give them some credit too. They also understand the root cause. The team's not doing this. Team's not doing that. Team's doing it this way. Team's doing it that way. Blah, 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 blah. But what they haven't been able to do is tell me, okay, so because the team is doing these, what's happened? Is revenue down? Well, we don't know. Or is the win rates declining? We don't know. Is the average sales price declining? We think so. Wait, well, where do you want it to be? Well, we haven't got that information yet. So, yeah, I believe they have a real problem, but I can't quantify it. I don't understand it. This is not a small effort. And so it's making me very uncomfortable because, you know, they're looking to spend a lot of money. And I don't think they have a way of measuring the success. I don't think they have a real understanding of what the cost is if they weren't to do it. How do you even know the cost of not doing it is exceeding the cost of the change, right? So there's a lot going on and I don't have all the information and we're trying and they're working with us, but it makes me very uncomfortable. Yeah, 100%.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about desired future state. So sometimes when we're exploring that stage on the qualification side, or one of the guys are they have to read Gap Selling to get a promotion in our business. So they have to prove that they've read it. And desired future state is something that gets explored in depth, right? But sometimes what we find is what people give us from the prospect side in desired future state isn't always realistic or based in reality. So how do you marry up the desired future state with the realistic future state? What are some explorations that we can do there?
Can you give me an example?
So our business, we effectively kick the doors down and get people meetings with their dream clients. That's what our business does. And sometimes I would ask the question of, if we work together, how would you know it was working? And they might say, well, I'd have sat and closed X amount of meetings in the first month. Now, I know what to say in terms of exploring that, but in your line of work, from your experience, when they would say, right, that's what I think constitutes success, how do I then cross-reference that against what's realistic?
All right, so you didn't use numbers, so I'm gonna guess here. But in the book, I talk about define everything. So, you know, that's very important. Here's a good example why. But I'm going to define it for you. So what I would do in that situation is, let's just say they basically, you set up meetings is what I'm getting, right? So if someone is only, let's say someone has a sales team of 25 right now and they're only setting up 17 meetings a week, which means eight of their salespeople aren't, or SDRs, whatever, aren't setting up meetings at all, right? And so 17 times 4, 34, 148 or something like that, 146 or something, terrible math, but I think we're almost there, 146, right? Meetings a month against 25 reps, so it should be at least 200 to 400, you know what I'm saying? So they're way off the number. And then, so that's where they are, and you've got all that out. And then, and you said, well, how would we measure success? Well, if we're getting 700 or 800 meetings, right, then I would say, okay, I love the enthusiasm, but let's talk about this for a second. What makes you believe, or where did that number come from? And I'll get them talking. And I might say, because that is a big stretch. That is an absolute big stretch. Based on our experience in today's world, blah, 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 a realistic number is 1 to 2 meetings a week by rep. Right now, you're doing 0.75, I think, if my math is right. And so if we could move you to something more industry average of 1 to 2, that would get you closer to 500, but that's not getting you to 700 or 800. So let's talk about this. Where did that number come from? Why is that number important to you? And let's talk about why we believe it's possible. Because with the existing team and our expertise, I don't think that's something that's possible, but I could be wrong. So I challenge him.
Sounds like what you're saying is almost we're going to take what you've said and run it through like a lawyer's evidence lens of where's the evidence and the logic in it.
Yes. It's always about the data. That's why I say define everything. That's the whole purpose of defining it. It's all about the data. Everything about gap selling is about the data. Everything. I don't care what it is you sell or who you sell to. It's all about the data.
So does that imply that the modern salesperson needs to be mathematically equipped to have these conversations?
No, because data doesn't always have to be a math equation, right? So here's an example. I had a client who said their future state was to exit at six figures in 2020. This is a past client. I talk about him in the book. Exit for six figures in 2020. For the five, I think it was the five owners, they were currently at X, like they're currently at $10 and they needed to get, they're currently like $25 and needed to get to $40 a year, you know what I'm saying, in revenue. And if they could do that, that once they crossed, I think it was the $30 or $35 a year revenue, I'm just making up numbers, that their valuation would go from 3 to 5 to 7 to 10. And they had some players in the industry had experienced that. So they knew that it wasn't just about, you know, the multiple 3 to 5X against revenue. They knew after a certain level that multiple also doubled. You see what I'm saying? So I'm really shitty at math. It's to the second power now, I believe, is what that is. So they were really smart about that. So they were very specific that we need to get past to this number to get this type of exit by this time. I don't need to be math. That's just data. This is where we're at. This is where we want to be. This is the reason we want to be there. This is the value to us at being there. This is our current growth rate. Our current growth rate doesn't get us there. Our current growth rate is 20% off. Mm. You see what I'm saying? You don't need a mathematical genius. You just got to get the data. Like literally just get the data. You know what it's like? It's like packing for a fucking trip. Some people throw a bunch of shit in the bag and they take off. Like, oh no, I forgot my bathing suit, right? Other people are like, okay, I'm going to the beach. This is what I need to maximize my experience at the beach. If I don't have this, I'm not in good shape. And they make a list and they go down and they check it. Do I have this? They got it. That's data. That's the data I'm talking about. So as a salesperson, your job is to dig in the current state. Where are you now? How many, like physical and literal, how many reps, what locations, blah, blah, blah. Problem, what problems do you have? Is it, you know, it depends on what you sell, but what problems, how many of those problems do you have? How big are those problems? Tell me the numbers against those problems, whether it's number of employees, number of mistakes, the fines you pay, like how many fines, how often, like it's just the data. It's just clearly getting all the information so you can properly assess what's going on, like a therapist. I got to know what's going on in the fucking relationship. And if I don't, I can't help you. I don't know if you're cheating. I don't know if you're talking to each other. I don't know how often you're intimate. I don't know if you tell you each other like each other. I don't know if you hold hands when you go out. I don't know how you discipline the kids. See what I'm doing? Just give me the data. And then I can properly assess what's going on and tell you what you should do.
You make it sounds so simple, yet I know so many salespeople, if they were the therapist, would run in there straight away and say, oh my God, I'm so glad you've come to me. Here's the Kama Sutra. See you later. And then just prescribe something off the back. So speaking of books, obviously gap selling is hugely successful. Have you noticed any like cultural quirks after gap selling? So how well does it dance in different cultures? So like from the UK to the USA, I'm sure that you do training all over the world. Have you seen culturally it's like a, oh my God, it doesn't land there, or actually it lands better in the UK than the US?
Okay, so yes, it doesn't land as well in Asia and doesn't quite land as well in the Middle East. However, to me, that is, I guess this would be cultural. Okay, so I guess it is cultural in that those two particular areas, and it's not 100%, it's just some, have a very difficult time acknowledging. No, I'll change it. There is less of the human element in the transactions in those cultures. So I'm actually doing some work with China right now for a separate project where I'm the buyer. And in China in particular, the transaction is so transactional. The culture is so transactional that they hurt themselves and nobody sees it. Like literally, now I don't know if it's because there are a few, I haven't figured out why exactly yet. I don't know if it's because there are a few options or people have just accepted it or whatever the case may be, but it is so transactional that no one stops and really thinks about the psychological elements. And because gap selling is based on the psychological concept of change, right? So it is so driven by price. And I literally said, okay, so what you're saying is you'll take the cheapest price. Yes. So if the cheapest price is a cheaper product that breaks every 4 weeks, you're still going to buy the cheapest product. And they freeze. They don't, well, it won't break. Okay. So they really don't apply the next level thinking to the outcome. You see what I'm saying? It is so locked in on price. And I think they built processes and approaches and cultural understandings, I don't know, to mitigate the downstream effects of that. But it's unbelievable. And I'll give you this quick example. My daughter's a major skier and we're going to design a ski line for her, right? And so I paid someone, a really, really good actually ski wear designer to design a pair of mogul pants for her. And so he did it total spec. Like this thing is nailed out exactly what they're supposed to do, the type of materials, where everything's supposed to go. It's this whole 8-page spec doc. And I set it out for bid. I get all these different prices back. I pick three. And two of the three argued with me on the tech specs to the point that they didn't even do what I asked and just sent it back the way they thought it should have been done. And then I get it. I'm like, what is this? This isn't what I put in the textbook. Well, our designer said that if you did it the way you're doing it, it would look funny and this and that. I'm like, hey, asshole, we know that it'll look funny because they're mogul pants. Mogul skiing requires a very baggy pant to hide the space between your legs so that when you're skiing, the judges can't see leg separation. It's designed for this. It's designed for that. And then the other thing is the kids, all the traditional ski pants do it like you just did it. And so the kids have to take a belt and take a 44 and squeeze it into like a 28-inch waist or 32-inch waist. And they don't like it. So I'm trying to solve that problem. And they're like, oh, well, we'll do it again. I'm like, you just wasted 8 weeks of my time. I needed those pants now as I fucking asked for them. Right? But the whole cultural concept was just very transactional. Just go, 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 go. So yeah, it doesn't land as well there because it doesn't allow for the dialogue. It doesn't allow for the problem solving. Everything's very reactionary, very reactionary.
You mentioned earlier about cybersecurity and insurance. So from a business landscape place, were there any other places where gap selling doesn't land or it's like it's quite tricky?
Gap selling just simply leverages the concept of change. That's all it's designed to do. If you're unhappy, if something is going on in your life that is intolerable or untenable, you are primed to change. The concept of gap selling is simply to help facilitate that change, by asking questions, by trying to understand, by getting the buyer or the person to understand, and then say, wow, you're right. You know what? I can't stay here. This is not serving me, right? That's why I use therapy a lot. It's not serving me. And so now that I've come to the conclusion that it's not serving me, and I can tell you why, and I can tell you the impact, et cetera, right? Then I have a platform to try to change. Okay, now that it's untenable because problem A and the impact that it's having on me, and it's happening because of these root causes. And if I don't change these root causes, this problem will stick and the impact will get worse. And I would like to be here instead. Now we've just created the template or the blueprint for change. That's all we've done. And once you get someone there, it's 10 times easier. The value is inherent to the gap. It's just inherent to the whole thing. So you can use it in marriages. You can use it to improve the marriage. You can use it to help a kid pick a school. You can use it to help a kid decide if they want to quit soccer. Like, you can use it in every single scenario in life, as long as the individuals engaged are properly committed to evaluating the problem. And that's why I said it doesn't do as well in China, because China, or I should say Asia is less problem centric in how they approach a sale in general.
So, Keenan, we get a lot of salespeople who are still in the trenches. They're picking up the phone every day. They're trying to qualify people from the outset. If you could give them one question to try and just incorporate in the game, might not work, but just something to try as a top question for you, what question would you throw at them and say, maybe try this to get people to open up?
Yeah, it's the question I threw out to you 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
Like, any version of that question, that is absolutely what should be asked every time. Like, I have people come to me all the time. Hey, Keenan, I'm really struggling with my girlfriend, man. Can you give me an ear? I'm like, yeah. First question, what's going on? Right? Someone's like, I cannot stand. I don't think I want to stay in school anymore. I don't like it. I want to get out. What do you think? My kid's not in school yet, but what do you think, Keenan? I don't know. First answer, I don't know. Tell me, what's going on? Why don't you think you like it? Notice what I said there. Why don't you think you don't like it, right? The whole first question should always be to get them to talk about their environment, to reflect on where they are. That is your first objective, to get the buyer to reflect on where they are. And the best way to start to get them to reflect on where they are is to get them to tell you about where they are. Now, what the trap is, sometimes a buyer or a person will start telling you what they need, particularly a buyer. Like, all right, tell me what's going on. Well, we need. Okay, so I understand that clearly something's going on, that you feel you need training. You feel that you need to get the salespeople to sell more. All right, I appreciate that. Can you tell me why? Why? What's going on that makes you feel you need training?
Beautiful.
And so I'm just trying to take them back, like, back to the current state. What's happening today that makes you feel that you need to spend that money? What's happening today that makes you feel that you need to take the team out of the field? What's happening today that makes you feel that you can't keep doing what you're doing?
Amazing. Thank you so much, Ken. I feel like we could talk all day. Gap selling's been a game changer for all our sales guys, so they all send their thank yous to you via us. What's next for you? Anything that we need to be talking about, looking out for in terms of what's going on with you and your world this year?
You know, I'm trying to do my next book. So I've got the data. Putting in a book is a lot harder than I thought. So we'll see. So I can promise you, if it's not a book, it will be a massive research study, or it'll be a book. So, but I'm going to tell everybody what I'm not going to tell. I'm going to relay back to the sales world what buyers are telling you they want us to do, and what is important to them to get from a seller, and how they want to be sold. Because I've interviewed or surveyed 1,200 salespeople, 1,200 buyers, and they can tell you, I'm going to tell you what they said.
So selling from the buyer's perspective.
Or reacting or responding to what the buyers say. Like, I can tell you, like, and it's interesting too, I can tell you what is most important to buyers, which is in one of the ones here, it's this big fat thing right here, right? Ooh, right. I can tell you that one of the things that's really interesting is, the number one thing that buyers want, or most valuable, how's the question stated? This is just one tiny little interesting example. What is the main thing a salesperson can help you do to move forward in the buying process? Know my business and help me understand and establish a strong ROI. Number one thing they say, not be a product expert, not communicate frequently, right? No. Know their business, right? So there's a lot that we're learning about the buyer and what the buyer wants from salespeople, and we're going to share that this year, either in a book or in the research in itself.
I'm excited. Keenan, thank you so much for joining us. If people want to check you out, buy your book, connect with you on LinkedIn, come on your show and try and gap sell to you, how can they get in contact with you?
Our website, LinkedIn. I mean, if you can't find me, I don't want to talk to you. you're not trying. Like, if you can't find me, you're not trying.
Yeah, I agree. So, I agree.
Keenan at LinkedIn. Yeah, I'm too easy to find. Run a Google search. Yeah, it's too easy.
Top man. Thank you so much for your time today, Keenan.
Thank you, guys. You were great.